Hi, I'm Leon Gorin, president of PEO Leadership, a peer-to-peer leadership advisory firm. We're an amazing community of CEOs, presidents, and senior executives. Ask yourself, are you learning as fast as the world is changing? It's time for Ontario business leaders to band together for counsel and support. It's time for you to tap into the business wisdom of our peer groups and unlock new ways to grow. I want you to come out of this COVID crisis a better leader and your organization ready for what's next. Take the first step at peo-leadership.com.
A New York Times best-selling author, an award-winning journalist, and the executive director of the Flow Research Collective. He's one of the world's leading experts on human performance and the author of 9 bestsellers out of 13 books total, including The Art of Impossible, The Future's Faster Than You Think, Stealing Fire, The Rise of Superman, Bold, and Abundance. His work has been nominated for 2 Pulitzer Prizes, translated into 40 languages, and appeared in over 100 publications, including the New York Times Magazine, Wired, Atlantic Monthly, Time, and the Harvard Business Review. Stephen's also the co-host of Flow Research Collective Radio, a top 10 iTunes science podcast, and along with his wife, author Joy Nicholson, is the co-founder of Rancho Chihuahua, a hospice and special needs dog sanctuary. So as I begin this session, here's how the hour is going to unfold. Fireside chat with Stephen will do for about 30 to 35 minutes, and then we'll open it up to Q&A and ask that you post your questions in the chat. What I'll do is I'll try and identify them, pick them up, and if possible, have you come off mute and ask Stephen the question directly. Try and think of questions, absolute general questions to Stephen, but you've got an expert in the room. So if you're really challenged with something, even at the moment, it's a great time to push that towards Stephen and see what he can do. So Stephen, it's so great to have you with us today. Thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
I know it's early. Where are you, in California this morning?
I'm in Northern Nevada, South Lake Tahoe on the Nevada side.
Oh, it's beautiful. Well, we're here in Toronto and spring has finally arrived. So it's awesome. We're all smiling. So I'm going to jump this right into this with you. And we're going to set the stage. And I know you have it. Obviously you do. The biological capability is all within us to achieve the impossible. Now, we can define impossible, the big I, the small I, but you fundamentally believe, and you've done the research, that we all have it within us. And I just want to make sure that that's how we start today, so everyone in this room gets it in their head that what they can do, it's within their own, their capabilities.
That is correct. I like to... Little more dramatic than I might have presented it, but it is foundationally correct. Yes. What 30 years of studying kind of I work on the neurobiology of peak human performance. So what's going on in the brain and the body when we're performing at our best. And there's a bunch of different things going on, but what you're really referring to, and when we say everybody's hardwired for the extraordinary, everybody's hardwired to tackle impossible challenges. One of the things we're talking about is that every human being, and in fact, most mammals, are hardwired to produce a state of consciousness known as flow, right? You may call it runner's high or being in the zone or being unconscious. Flow is a technical term. It is technically defined as an optimal state of consciousness. We feel our best and we perform our best. We're all familiar with it. Flow refers to any of those moments of rapt attention and total absorption. You get so focused on the task at hand, everything else just seems to disappear. Action awareness will start to merge. Your sense of self-consciousness, that's going to diminish. Time's going to pass strangely. It'll speed up and 5 hours will go by in like 5 minutes. Maybe it'll slow down and you'll get a freeze frame effect. Maybe anybody's been in a car crash. And throughout, all aspects of performance, both mental and physical, go through the roof. So when we say everybody's capable of the extraordinary, flow is an extraordinary boost to our capabilities. Motivation, grit, learning rates, creative problem solving, productivity, empathy, environmental awareness, strength, fast twitch, muscle response. I can go on. All of these things massively increase in flow. In some cases, 500% above baseline. And let me give you one example just to make that even a little more clear. McKinsey, the business consultancy, went around the globe talking to CEOs, top leaders, about how much more productive they felt in flow. And it's self-reported, it's a grain of salt, but they spent a decade doing it. And the average was 500% more productive. 11% more productive means you can go to work on Monday, spend Monday in a flow state. You take Tuesday through Friday off, you're still going to get as much done as everybody else. 2 days a week in flow, you're 1,000% more productive than the competition. So this is a massive acceleration above baseline, and it's available to each and every one of us. If I were to put it more broadly, I would say, look, peak performance, whatever you want to call peak performance, it's nothing more or less than getting our biology to work for us rather than against us. And that's a limited set of skills. Flow is a big part of it. There's some other things that come into play, but the biology is limited. So if we can get it optimized, if we can get it working together, working the way the system was designed to work, the way it evolved to work, we get farther, faster with a lot less fuss. That's the big deal.
No, that makes a lot of sense, and I agree. Thanks for starting with the flow, because that, as I went through your book, and you and I talked about this, right? You broke it down into motivation, creativity, learning and creativity. The flow flows through the whole thing, every one of those different chapters. Today, you know, I'm thinking about the environment we all live in today, right? So in U.S. is maybe a little bit different than Canada, but we're still in the midst. I think North American-wide, we're all through going through COVID. Hopefully, we're in the marathon. The finish line's coming, we're hoping, at least it's within vision. I know there's a lot of reflection going on by a lot of people today. Like, we've gone through a year of this. It's been insanity. In the beginning, the motivation, what I'm trying to understand, and maybe you can help the audience here, as they reflect, I kind of think it's almost a great time to start thinking about finding that new passion, finding that new purpose, potentially revitalizing themselves. And in that early section of your book, and you talk motivation, you talk about finding the passion. Maybe walk us through some of the ideas around that, people who are going through this a little bit right now, where they would start.
Perfect. So let me put, when we say motivation, which is, where, if you're interested in peak performance, as you mentioned,
yeah,
there are four major sets of skills. There are motivational skills, learning skills, creativity skills, and flow skills. If you want a simple way to think about it, motivation gets you into the game. Learning allows you to continue to play. Creativity is how you steer, and flow is how you turbo boosts the results beyond expectation. That's the simple way to think about it. But when you say motivation or learning or creativity or even flow, scientifically, these are catch-all terms, right? Motivation doesn't just mean motivation. It means extrinsic motivation, stuff we want in the real world that we'll work hard for, money, sex, fame. Intrinsic motivation, curiosity, passion, purpose, autonomy, mastery, right? Things that really drive us on the inside. We also mean grit and goals. At the heart of the question is, where do you start? At a basic level, where you want to always want to start is, just to put it in context, is with extrinsic motivation. What the science is really clear on this, starting with Abraham Maslow and going all the way through Danny Kahneman today. If you want to increase motivation, the first place you got to start is with safety and security motivation. You have to make enough money to pay your rent, to pay your bills, and to not worry, right? That's probably not a problem for anybody listening today, but it is probably an issue for some of your employees. So if you're trying to motivate employees, right, and they are literally wondering, you know, can I make my rent? Can I pay my bills? Where's my next paycheck going to come from? You literally can't. You're blocking peak performance. If people have the anxiety that comes from that, it stands in the way of all peak performance. Once that problem is solved, intrinsic motivation comes next. Internal motivators. There are tons of internal drivers, but there are five big ones, right? Curiosity, passion, purpose, autonomy, and mastery. And they're designed to work together. They're designed to come online in a specific order. And the way you should think about this, and this is the answer to your question, Leanne, if you're looking for more passion and purpose in your life, curiosity is the foundational ingredient in passion. When we say curiosity, when we're curious about something, the brain produces a little bit of norepinephrine and a little bit of dopamine. These are performance-enhancing neurochemicals. They do a bunch of things in the brain and the body, but mainly they drive focus. So when you're curious about something, you pay attention to it. No work required. Happens automatically. If you can find the intersection of multiple curiosities, where three or four of your curiosities intersect, that's the seed kernel of passion. passion is mystified in today's world. We hear all about it. Oh, I want to find my passion. It's super important. And like, first of all, what's the big deal about passion? You get focus for free. That's the big deal. It produces a shit ton of norepinephrine and dopamine. And like, think about romantic love. When you fell in love with, you know, your first girlfriend or boyfriend, how much attention were you paying? You couldn't stop focusing on them. It happened automatically. You didn't have to do hard work. So if you can find the intersection with a place where multiple curiosities intersect, and start to kind of play there, meaning find the intersection and just learn more and more about that intersection 20 minutes a day. Just play there, play there, play there. Start getting some easy wins in that intersection. It'll start to build, it'll start to build, it'll start to build. That's how you kind of develop passion. You then literally can take that passion and you couple it to a cause greater than yourself, something outside yourself, right? I like to say, make a list of 25 things you're curious about, then find places that, you know, four or five tend to intersect, right? I'll give you an example. Let's say, and one thing when you're doing this work, you want to be as specific as possible. The brain works really well with specifics. It doesn't work with generalities. So it's not, I'm interested in football and food. It's, I'm interested in the mechanics of what does it take to play left tackle, and I'm interested in insects as a new protein source. Okay, those are your two curiosities. And by curiosity, I mean, like, you got a free weekend. You want to spend it reading some books, watching some movies, talking to an expert. Like, we're not, you know, this is not complicated. Where do football and food intersect? Well, I don't know. Left tackle is a job that requires a lot of energy. Do insects make a good food source for playing left tackle? That's the intersection. Spend 20 minutes researching that today, tomorrow, the next day, see if it starts to cook, right? One curiosity, there's not enough energy there for passion. You find multiple intersections, there's energy there, then you couple it to a problem that is greater than yourself. And what happens when you do that, again, purpose is one of these terms that, like, we sort of mystify in the modern world. We think, oh, purpose, it's so altruistic. It's so great for the world. You're such a good person. You have purpose. You want to help the world. That may be true. But from a biological peak performance perspective, purpose is entirely selfish. You take the norepinephrine and dopamine, the feel-good performance-enhancing reward chemicals that show up with passion, and then you get more feel-good reward neurochemistry. You get endorphins, oxytocin, serotonin, all the chemicals that show up once there's other people involved in a situation. When you're trying to solve a problem in the world, you're helping other people, and you get pro-social reward chemicals as a reward. So what do you get? You get more feel-good drugs on the inside and greater productivity on the outside. Focus for free everywhere you want to go.
What would you tell people in terms of finding that passion? Like, you talk about 20 minutes a day. Is it a process that will take me a month or two? Is it a process that will take me a couple of years? Will it change? Like, what happens when my passions change over time? And can I have more than one?
First of all, two things, right? One, the really slow breakdown is in The Art of Impossible, the new book. But I'm putting something in the chat. We took the front of the book, the passion recipe, which is how do you turn curiosity into passion into purpose, and turned it into a free workbook and or kind of video breakdown of how to do it. So I just put that in the chat. That's available to anybody. You can go there and go crazy in how to do it. Here's the thing. You want to do this slowly. In peak performance, there are a handful of places where you have to go slow to go fast. Passion, cultivating passion and turning passion to purpose is really important. And the reason is simply this. You do not want to be 2 years into your passion to discover, oh, it's only a phase, right? Like, I had a friend who got super passionate about archaeology, like, out of nowhere. Suddenly they're going to be career change. I'm an archaeologist. They get all crazy about it, all worked up, and set up for a 2-year dig in Egypt. And they get like 6 weeks into the dig and they're like, I freaking can't stand this. And I'm like, I'm now slave labor for the next 18 months. And yeah, you really want to do this slowly and don't be impatient with yourself. The biology is actually designed to work a little more slowly here for a lot of these reasons. So you can't be impatient with yourself in any of this work. Being impatient with yourself, really, it's just so costly. To do peak performance work, self-forgiveness and patience are just really key. You'll just get so much more work done with so much less pain if you have a little bit of self-forgiveness and a little bit of patience with the process.
I love that. The other thing that struck me as
thank you, Jeff. I'm sorry. I'm a moron. I'm a smart moron, but I'm still a moron.
Do we spell it wrong, Stephen? No, I hope not.
No, I put a the there where there wasn't one.
That's great. So the other thing I picked up here that I really think big, like there isn't, you know, you talk about it numerous times in that book. It's not just, we need to extend our thinking. We need to think bigger than we're actually thinking a lot of the time, especially.
Well, the way I always explain this to people, because it's really, you'll get it when you, so I spent my whole career around people who've accomplished capital I impossible, right? Yeah. That which has never been done. And that's what I've spent my career studying. When you get under the hood, right? I'll give a simple example from my own personal experience. One of my closest friends and my partner, sometime writing partner, we've written three books together, Peter Diamandis, was the original founder of the XPRIZE. And the XPRIZE unlocked the space frontier. Peter wanted to make private space travel available to anyone. He wanted to go into space. He knew NASA wasn't going to give him a ride, right? He was too short. He didn't follow directions well. Like he was not astronaut material. He knew it, right? But he wanted to unlock the space frontier. And so he created the XPRIZE. And it was a private competition for the first outside team that can build a private spaceship, go into space twice in 2 weeks. And that's a reusable spaceship. It was the thing that nobody could build and unlock the space frontier. And when he proposed it, I wrote the first international major article on Peter, right? And I talked to everybody in the aerospace community, and they all basically said, Peter is out of his freaking mind. This is never going to happen. It's impossible. Then I talked to NASA. They sort of reiterated everybody's point in much more colorful language. And they were like, look, we get to the moon. We took 10,000 engineers and it took $10 billion. And that's what it's going to take. Anybody, there's no way, you know, you put up $10 million for a team. It's never going to happen. This is crazy. You're out of your freaking mind. And yet 8 years later, Burt Rutan wins the XPRIZE with a $30 million spaceship and a team of 30 engineers and unlocks the space frontier. And private space is now a $3 billion a year industry and growing gangbusters, right? That's an impossible thing he did. And I got to watch the entire thing up close and personal. So what does it look like to see the impossible become possible up close and personal? Check it out. Peter wakes up. He eats breakfast. He talks on the phone for a little while. Then he types into his computer. Then he goes to the bathroom. Then he comes back, he types on his computer, and he gets on a different phone call. And then a different phone call. Then he has lunch. After lunch, maybe he takes a nap. Maybe he goes to the gym, and he has more phone calls, a couple more conversations, and then there's food. Sound familiar? We all have the same 24 hours in the day. We all basically do the same thing in those 24 hours. Often, the only difference between do I want to unlock the space frontier or do I want to become the best dry cleaner in Shaker Heights, Ohio. The energy requirement is the same. If you're interested in being the best, you're going to give everything you got to every moment. That's what we do when we're interested in being the best. So the energy and what you're doing with it, it's roughly the same. It's the size of the original vision that matters so much. I talk a lot about this in my book, Bold, which was a book on how do you solve impossible business challenges. And it came from spending a lot of time with Larry Page, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Richard Branson, people who've done possible business things in near record time. And we talked a lot about Google's moonshots, right? What's a moonshot? A moonshot is, right, a 10x improvement over existing, right, structures. So it's 1,000 times better. And if you talk to the guys at Google about, like, what's the advantage with moonshots, they'll say, look, sure, you're going to fail a bunch. It's going to happen, right? These are moonshots. But it is often easier to go for something that is 1,000 times better than something that's 10% better. Because if you're 10% better, you're suddenly in a smartness contest with everybody else in the world who's trying to be 10% better. But if you're 1,000% better, you have to throw out everything that's existing, all the rules, all the technology, all the ideas. You've got to start over. And that's a liberating structure that often makes it easier to go big rather than go small. And as you pointed out, as we started this, for a lot of different biological reasons, the human brain is actually hardwired to go big. We're hardwired for self-actualization. We want to become the very best version of ourselves. That's how we're biologically designed. Or, as Abraham Maslow famously said, whatever a human being can be, they must be.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you for that. As you think big, one thing that strikes me, maybe this leads into the next thing, we're all gonna run into roadblocks. So I'm gonna assume everyone knows how to set goals. Maybe they don't know the big goals, but they bring it down into smaller goals. But as we're working towards that impossible, whatever we define it as, for each of us, it's different. We're going to run into walls all the time. You talk about the grit element, the ferocity element, bringing flow into it. Can you share some ideas around the challenges we face or we're going to face as we move towards impossible and perhaps overcoming them a little bit, trying to trigger flow to help us overcome them on a short-term basis? I'm dropping stuff here.
I just thought there was somebody very small living under your desk.
Yeah, well, my dog's big, but it was me that dropped that.
One of the really interesting, you're going to run into a challenge. Let's not kid ourselves. Whether, it's capital I impossible doing that, which has never been done, small I impossible, that's stuff we think is impossible for ourselves, or even if you just want to be more productive and creative at work next week. Good news is the biology is the same, the toolkit's the same. The bad news is it's not easy. Like, it's not easy in general here on planet Earth, and peak performance isn't easy. I will say that I really think that the only thing worse than the pain of stalking the impossible is the pain of not trying to stalk the impossible. I think trying to live with ourselves and live with underachievement is much more difficult than stalking the impossible. I will also tell you, this is just a cool random thing, but it tends to be true. Not entirely, and I'll give you caveats, but here's the one thing you should know, and then we'll go into grit. So we have what are known as emotional set points. These are created roughly by the time we're 10, 11, or 12, and we have a low point and a high point. The low point is roughly the worst we're going to feel on the planet. The high point is roughly the best we're going to feel. Most of life takes place in the middle. Now, you can move these points, right? Regular access to flow will increase the upper end of the emotional set points. Life gets better a lot. Death of a child or chronic unemployment will lower the lower set point. But other than that, life is going to take place inside the interim. Now, I want you to think about something. You've all been teenagers. What does being a teenager mean? It means that your brain is not fully developed. It means you have no emotional regulation capabilities. And it means your hormones are raging. In other words, you've already probably felt the very worst you're going to feel on this planet. If you survived being a teenager and you've made it into adulthood, you're actually already tough enough to take anything that's coming, with a couple of exceptions. You may have to deal with that agony a couple days in a row. It may stretch out for a longer period of time, but honest to God, like, we don't think about it because nobody talks about it this way, but like, a lot of people are like, oh God, what if I can't achieve what? Well, I don't know, but you've already experienced the worst probably that you can feel actually. So one, you're tough enough to take it. Two, what the research shows about grit is it is easier to train grit after you sort of get all your intrinsic motivators pointed in the same direction, because once that happens, you're going to start automatically. A lot of the intrinsic motivators are flow triggers. They preconditions that lead to more flow. Flow massively amplifies grit. Once an experience starts producing flow, we love it. We go extraordinarily out of our way to get more of it, and grit sort of takes care of itself. To put it in more specific terms, they did a really cool study of like a giant high school, 542 students, and they looked at the students, what they called their primary secondary activity. School was their primary activity. So this primary second, you play tuba in the band, you play football, right? Are you in debate club, whatever it was? And they asked, what conditions, if you're doing this freshman year, what are the conditions that guarantee that you had the grit to still be doing it when you graduated as a senior? And what they found is there was only one condition. Experiences that produced the most flow as a freshman, those were the guarantees that they were going to still be doing it as a senior. Flow and grit are often very synonymous. which is why you want to start training grit after you sort of got everything pointed in the same direction and starting to produce flow. So one, that makes the grit training easier. You're less likely to burn out. It's less likely to be as miserable, and it's much more rewarding along the way. The other thing is this. We are designed, biologically hardwired, for grit. I mean, human beings are incredibly gritty. For example, we are the only species that evolved to run down our prey. Human beings are designed to be gritty enough to chase an antelope across a desert for 3 days and catch it for dinner. We are so gritty on the inside from an evolutionary perspective, it's insane. We just now, William James pointed this out, the quotes in The Art of Impossible, but like 100 years ago, he said, look, we all have the experience of second wind. We've all had that experience. You're exhausted, you're tired, whether it's at work or you're doing something athletic or whatever, and suddenly you have a second wind. What most people don't realize is there's a third wind, a fourth wind, a fifth wind, a sixth wind, because you're not reliably pushing on your skills. So the good news is grit is remarkably easy to train. It's really easy to train. The bad news is it doesn't feel very good. One secret, though, which is kind of counterintuitive, because I'm guessing that most people, you know, on the Zoom call, they want more grit at work. They may want a little more grit at the gym, or they might want a little more grit in their relationships or whatever, but you really want to be a little grittier at work. What's interesting is if you want cognitive grit, what the research shows is you want to start on the physical side. So you literally want to start in the gym or with whatever kind of physical activity. This is not always the case that the body has primacy over the mind. Like, that's not, there's a bunch of physical chauvinists in the embodied cognition world that you'll bump into if you get into this world at all, who like to tell you that, oh, the body is the master thing and don't worry about the brain, start with the body. It's not true at all, except for grit. So like, if you literally want to be more gritty at work, what you want to start doing is, if you're going to the gym and you're doing, you know, 10 exercises, 3 sets of 10 each exercise, next time you go to the gym, it's 2 sets of 10 and 1 set of 11 on one of those exercises. You start really small and you just push a little bit and a little bit and a little bit. And what you're trying to do is literally just teach your brain that you're tough enough to take it. Grit is less about, can I persevere? And more about teaching the brain that you're not going to die if you persevere, right? Because the brain wants to convince you that you're going to die if you push through this, and nothing could be farther from the truth.
So I think those on the call, and there's a lot of leaders on the call, they had to have grit. They didn't get to where they were without grit, because everyone's gone through some challenges, especially in the business world. Maybe this is outside of the context of the book, but as leaders, one of the challenges we have is engaging and inspiring our people, right? So driving, getting them passionate, having them have a purpose around the organization to push forward, helping them develop some grit to actually push forward as well. You've worked with a lot of leaders. Is there anything that sticks out in your mind in terms of how they've been effective within their organization, engaging others? Like, what we've talked about today is engaging ourselves. We can control that. Are there tricks that we can use to engage our teams and our people to get them as passionate and engaged?
Yeah. So two things are pretty clear. So the first is psychological safety. That's been everywhere these days, right? But simply put, anxiety blocks peak performance, right? The more anxiety in our system, the worse we're going to perform. And this is why you're seeing gratitude practices or mindfulness practices, or the best way to fight anxiety, by the way, gratitude practice, mindfulness, or breath work, focused meditation, or exercise. So one of the reasons you're seeing so much of that stuff rolled out, place to start, it calms people down. Group flow is the shared collective version of a flow state, right? It's what you want in your team. It's a team performing at their very best. And group flow, like flow, has triggers. There are preconditions that will lead to more group flow. There are 10 that are known. This is not my work. It was the work of a guy named Keith Sawyer. He's a psychologist at the University of North Carolina, who originally identified these things. So if you want more passion, performance, grit, all that stuff from your team, one of the things to do is really pay attention to group flows, triggers. You can find a really full breakdown at the end of my recent book, The Art of Impossible. Keith Sawyer wrote a fantastic book called Group Genius about all his work on how he came up with these. Both of those are a really decent place to start. You'll note when you look at the group flow triggers, there is a lot of overlap between some of the triggers and psychological safety. And a lot of the triggers are less about how you act in the room with the team and more about how do you build the team? How do you design high flow teams? And the third thing that I think is just, I mean, this is so obvious. It was funny. I was Daniel Goleman, who basically invented emotional intelligence. And I were talking about a month ago about this very question, because he has spent really a ferociously long time, 30 years now, looking at emotional intelligence in leaders, what makes a good leader, the very question you asked, he's really looked at it. And so when I was talking to him, I was picking his brain on the same thing. I wrote, at the Flow Research Collective, 70 people work for me, right? We're a mid-sized company. And, I am an old school punk rocker from Cleveland, Ohio. I'm not a guy who's like ever thought he was going to be, leading, a eight-figure company with 70 people. So I've had to learn a lot of this stuff on the fly also as well. And one of the things we were talking about, and I was laughing because I fall short on this as well, is if you're going to be a visionary leader and have passionate people underneath you, you have to be communicating that vision to your company, right? In Art of Impossible, I talk about the three tiers of goal setting. The top is a massively transformative purpose, right? Massively transformative purpose is a mission statement for your life. Underneath that, you'll find hard goals and then clear goals. And they're all sort of chunks of the bigger thing. But massively transformative purposes came out of work that Peter Diamandis, myself, and a guy named Salim Ismail, who was the original executive director of Singularity University, where they study exponential technology and how you apply it to innovation, solving global challenges. We were doing a study, Salim pioneered it, of the 100 fastest growing companies in the world. And one of the things that we found is they all had massively transformative purposes. And it was extremely well communicated to all the employees. And I'm not talking about your like crappy mission statement that you wrote. I'm talking about this is Google. Organize the world's information. It's something that everybody can focus on. Everybody knows where the company's going and what they're doing, et cetera, et cetera. Those are really, really useful. If you're looking for passion, if you're looking for grit, you need shared goals is a flow trigger, right? It's a group flow trigger. And a shared massively transformative purpose is a very powerful place to start with an organization.
I love that. That vision bigger than the organization or that purpose, the MTP you described, shared goals, and then the ability to win together and share those wins. I mean, I think about sports, right? You could be in an individual sport, but if it's a team sport, big gymnastics, swimming we talked about, right? The flow that happens when your teammates start to win carry right through you and increase your performance.
This is, the other thing, by the way, is all the flow stuff. Flow is contagious. Emotions are contagious. There's a facial signature for flow. When we move into flow at a micro-expression level, your frown muscles are paralyzed and your smile muscles are hyperactive. Facial expressions, because we're mirror neuron systems, are automatic. So like I mimic your facial expressions when I talk to you, this is how we bond, right? This is, by the way, also why people start looking like they're dogs. Since you have a dog in your office, I thought I'd mention this, right? Your dogs are actually better face readers than humans. They're always looking at your face, reading your emotions. And the way they can figure out what you're feeling is they mimic your face to feel your feelings, because that's how mirror neurons work. So why do our dogs end up looking like owners and owners like their dogs? Because you guys are mimicking facial expressions over the years.
I thought they were just people walking down my street saying you look like your dog.
I take that as a compliment. I think my dogs are very handsome.
That's great. All right, I'm going to go to some questions. Some questions are coming in. I know I can keep pumping these questions out, but Daryl Cardon, if you want to come off mute and ask a question directly to Stephen.
Before we head into the Q&A portion of this webcast, first, a brief note about PO leadership from one of our members.
What I love about PEO leadership right now is how well our members are supporting each other and rising to face the COVID-19 challenge.
Paul Zadorsky, Senior Vice President, Crayola International.
Business is all about being able to rapidly adapt to change, but how do you learn as fast as the world changes?
PEO leadership lets you tap into the collective wisdom of some of Canada's top executives.
Having that peer group and broader leadership community to lean on, it makes all the difference.
The time to step up and lead is now. Go to peo-leadership.com.
You bet. Hey, Stephen. I love the book. One of the things that surprised me in it was when you talked about getting after your biggest and hardest task first, like implying that productivity was kind of a depleting resource like willpower. I was expecting that to read you say that like the dopamine you would get from task completion would kind of act as neurobiological leverage that would then help you get after a bigger task and a bigger task where you kind of crescendo throughout the day due to the neurochemistry. Can you talk a little bit about why?
Daryl, that's one of the smartest questions I've been asked in a really long time. I can absolutely, it's totally logical why you would think that. And I haven't had an answer. I've never heard the question asked before. And it seems totally obvious. Like, why hasn't somebody said, here's what I think is the answer. And the person I need to call is Roy Baumeister, who did all the work on willpower. He's probably the person who would have the best answer to this question. And it might already be in his data somewhere, though I haven't seen it. What I think is this, and now, let's say this is an 80-85% answer, and there's 15% there. I'm probably way off base. But the cognitive load that comes from your hardest task, right, is usually so significant that once you clear it out of the way, you end up liberating so much more energy for focus and attention that is probably coupled to the fact that willpower declines over time. You put those two things together, and I would guess those forces are stronger than the dopamine high. Now, here's the couple of caveats that totally throw a wrench under all this. If your hardest task drives you into a really deep macro flow state, cool, fantastic, you'll get push all the way through the day. But let's say one of the things that will drive flow is a little bit of dopamine is a focusing chemical. You start stacking up dopamine in the system. Now, if your tasks are 2 hours long and whatever, the dopamine is not, dopamine lasts about 20 minutes. So it's not gonna linger long enough to do that. But if some of the tasks are really short, there might be something to what you're saying. Like there might be, what I think is a general rule, my prescription is going to win over time, but there are going to be, I guarantee you, if we were to look at this, there are going to be very specific kinds of situations. They may vary individual to individual, so there may not be a prescriptive that I can say, oh, this will work for everybody. That could be true, but I think there are going to be situations when your way is better. I don't quite know what those are. One, social, like if you have a really hard meeting, if you're a salesperson, right, and there's a really tough customer, you probably don't want them to be your first customer, right? You probably want a little bit of a groove and some of that dopamine, the pro-social chemicals. So that's one situation where I can think, okay, I can see your way working better than, the way that we talk about in the book, it's what 30 years of kind of research and data has told us. But it's science we overturn ideas all the time. So you asked a really great question. I don't have a great answer for you. I fumbled around my way. Roy Baumeister is going to be the person who does have that great answer, I think. I'm now going to call him. It's a cool question that I hope my answer is satisfactory a little bit.
Great. Thanks for the question.
Oh, you bet. Thanks.
Tom Kay. I see you on my screen. You want to come off mute and ask your question?
Sure. And by the way, I haven't read the book, but I plan to. It's ordered, so it will be corrected. I just had a question in terms of the possibility. So Google might have big goals, but they don't chase every one of them, right? So I find these days in the marketplace, and I'm technology, people tend to pivot very quickly because they get all these new technologies coming at them. So the real question is how to distinguish between, you know, the practical component of chasing that big idea. And you know, because you can't just chase everything that looks like the next great thing, right? So do you have some thoughts on how people filter those things?
So if you're asking a business technology question, that answer is probably in my book, The Future is Faster Than You Think. In terms of how do you track exponentially growing technology? Where is it going? What are the markets going to do? All those. So there's that side of the question. Let me stay on the human performance side of the question a little bit for you, because that's a different thing. I think there's two things that are important here. The first is we all know, if we're good at business, that there are certain situations where the very best thing to do is to like walk away and start someplace, right? There are times you got to shut it down. Ah, this project. But Google, as you pointed out, Google kills way more stuff than they let live, right? They, when in their skunk works in Google X, the ratio is crazy. It's like 100 to 1 in terms of what they kill versus what they let live. And there are a bunch of different organizational, you know, gateways to do that. You know, one of the things that we do organizationally at the Flow Research Collective, and this is, I have a different answer for you, but I'm just going to throw this out, is when it comes to these things is we periodize making sure we're asking the questions that sort of don't allow us to, like, you know, everybody's trying to systematize things and streamline and that stuff. But every 2 to 3 months we have big meetings where we're like, okay, we built systems, we streamlined, we tried these processes. Now what blind spots did we create along the way? And what are we totally not looking at? And let's reevaluate this stuff that way. So that's just one of the things we do. That's not my answer. My answer to you is on a more personal level is this. The way I think about it for my own life is this. And what the research shows is that you want 3 tiers of goal setting: massively transformative mission statement goals, high hard goals that are the chunks that feed into your mission statement, and then clear goals. What are you doing today to feed into your higher goals, to feed into your mission goals? So let's say one of your goals is to, you know, make movies that inspire, you know, audiences worldwide. That's your mission level goal. So, you know, a high hard goal would be go to film school. Make your first movie about cooking, make blah, blah. Okay, you get the idea. And clear goals, what am I going to do today to make that for, right? That's how the system works. But what those goals are, especially at the top, is they're filters. I have 3 mission level goals for my life. And then there's 3 things I have to do almost every day to support those goals, right? And I know that. Those are my first filters. If a project comes my way and it fits with those goals, great. I say yes. If it doesn't, it's gone. It's a waste of my time because I'm driving in a certain direction. So one thing about this level of goal setting is it becomes your first filter for your life, predominantly because I know if it's not aligned with my core mission, right, and my core passion, my core purpose, and all that stuff, there's no way I can be my best at it. So it should go out automatically because I don't know how you play, but I try to play to be best in the world at things, right? If I can't be best in the world at something or try to be best in the world at something, I'm not going to get into it. I'm going to say no. So that's something more on a personal level to do that. But like I do think that how to know when to walk away from a project is one of the very complicated, cool, interesting, difficult business and life questions that I don't think we're 100% there yet. I really don't. It's like you guys are asking great questions, and I wish I was smarter than I am. I'm taking it as far as I can.
Trust me, you're smart. After reading,
you guys are asking hard questions.
Thank you.
I think I agree with you. I think you talked from a personal perspective. I think about corporate strategy maps, right? Where you have the huge BHAGs at the top, the goals that are laid down. It's a one pager, and we filter ideas through that all the time. If it doesn't fit within the boxes in terms of direction of where you're going, you can inquire, you can ask the questions around it. But that's one of the, that's how actually we filter stuff to make sure that everyone is aligned, driving towards a similar goal. Personally, you could do the same thing, change the corporate strategy into a life GPS, which is a model moving forward. Stephen, another question. Somebody's asked me to ask you this. They're on the treadmill. So I think, here we go. I think one of the most overlooked energy issues is the inordinate amount of time we spend using our precious mental energy on non-priorities. We always think in terms of energy use in physical activities and not mental. The most productive and fulfilled people I know are masters at picking spots to use their mental energy and controlling their mental, emotional state and thoughts. Can you perhaps comment on that or expand?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's... You nailed something really foundational, which is people think physical energy is, you know, more work than mental energy, and it's not. Your brain uses 25% of your energy at rest. It's 2% of your body mass, 25% of your energy at rest. If you're focused and paying attention, especially if you're paying attention to something that you're it's difficult, that's hard to pay attention to, that requires something, or there's more stress, you're using a huge amount of energy. The level of stupid I am after an entire day spent writing or in meetings versus the level of stupid I am after an entire day spent skiing or, you know, riding my bike, I'm way stupider after the cognitive stuff. Just there's no way around it. It burns way more energy most of the time, unless you're, you know, if your friend on the treadmill is trying to put in, you know, 4-minute, 5-minute miles, okay, you may be winning. You may be burning more energy than I am right now talking to you guys, but it's doubtful.
That's great. All right, next question.
By the way, hold on. Let me caveat there. Two things okay. I want to mention about this. This is also why across the boards, we see that you need 7 to 8 hours a night of sleep a night for peak performance. No questions asked. Sorry, I seem to have...
No worries. Take your time.
Yeah, I'm going to start coughing again, but we'll just play through. And you should also have an active recovery protocol in place. So don't finish work and television and beer, not active recovery. That's a passive recovery protocol that we think actually helps us recover and doesn't at all. Alcohol, if you have more than 2 cocktails, is going to screw up your sleep patterns. It's going to rob you of the sleep you need. And television, because of how it affects our brain waves, it makes us feel like we're relaxing. But the brain is actually not relaxing. The brain reacts to television as if there was a crisis almost every 30 seconds. You don't feel it at all, but at a you can see it in brain waves. That's not recovery. To actually recover at the end of a long, hard work day when you're cognitively depleted, what the research shows is you want something that will automatically lower cortisol and norepinephrine levels in the body, so flush out stress hormones and alter brain waves, drop brain waves from where they are. High beta is where we are right now. It's a fast-moving wave. It's awake, alert, paying attention, down to alpha, daydream mode, much slower. That's what the brain needs to reset. So how do you do that? Epsom salt baths, restorative yoga. So this is not yoga for exercise. This is yoga like stretching and calm with breathing. A focused meditation practice of any kind. Exercise can sometimes help. Sometimes it's gardening or like a long walk, but a restorative practice at the end of your day that changes brain waves and helps flush stress hormones out of your system. One, it's part, if you don't have it, you're much more likely to burn out. In fact, there's a lot of work that we've done at the Flow Research Collective that says if you have regular access to flow through what's known as your primary flow activity, and we can come back to that for a second, and an active recovery protocol in place, and you're getting 7 to 8 hours of sleep at night, it's almost impossible to burn out. You can do it if you are if you have a boss who's super passive aggressive, who keeps moving the goalposts, or a spouse, or any situation where like you can't please somebody, and that situation get out of it. You're going to burn out no matter what. It's automatic. There's nothing you can do to win situations. Just get the hell out of that situation. But primary flow activity is whatever that thing is that you've done your whole life that drops you into flow. For me, it's skiing. For other people, it's walking their dog in nature, or playing chess, or dancing to salsa, or dancing hip hop, or, you know, reading, or doesn't matter. Take your pick. These are all the things that, by the way, we put down in adulthood. What's the first thing? We become adults. We're responsible. We have families. We have jobs. We put away childish things. I'm putting away the surfboard or the skateboard or the whatever. And it's actually a disaster for performance for a bunch of different reasons. One is, as we move into flow, all the stress hormones are pushed forcefully out of our system. It happens automatically, replaced by feel-good performance-enhancing neurochemicals that also boost the immune system. So in a time of COVID, primary flow activities really matter because you're doing some good things for that. Also, the more flow you get, the more flow you get. So if you get flow skiing on Monday, you're training the brain to focus in a particular way. You're going to get more flow at work on Tuesday. And the heightened productivity and heightened creativity. So productivity 500% above baseline, creativity is 400-700% above baseline. That seems to outlast the flow state by a day, maybe two. So great reasons to double down on your primary flow activity. But if you're fighting burnout, primary flow activity, if you can, an afternoon week is best, but even 10 minutes, you know, here and there is great. But like 3 or 4 hours a week is best. But that plus 7-8 hours of sleep a night, plus like an active recovery protocol. So 10 minutes of focused meditation at the end of the day, or a 20-minute infrared sauna, or 15-minute yoga practice seems to block burnout.
Stephen, is this related to, so it was one of the questions I'm going to ask you, because in sports, when you train for that one big achievement, you train really hard, you achieve it, you get that flow, you get in the moment. Use flow through the whole process. But when you do break that record, whatever it is that you achieve, you find that people get depressed. Like you go through a lull, and it's not a lull just for a day or two. Like I actually, personally, I'll find this. If I work hard, 2 days later, I'm actually dropped down big time. Big event, drop down for months. And we see that in mental illness with a lot of athletes. I'm going to put that in the context of today. We've been battling COVID for 9 to 10 months, right? As soon as it's done and we've gotten through this thing, we mental health is going to be an issue. Is this recovery process we can use?
Yeah, it's a really good point. It's a really good point you just made, because I've been saying this all along. One of the things about flow is neurobiologically, evolutionarily, this is the brain reacting to crisis situations. That's why it evolves. So flow is sort of this work is custom designed for COVID. So we've been doing a lot of hardcore, serious work with individuals and organizations around this very question. And yeah, you are totally right. So the thing is, COVID itself is creating preconditions that are leading to stress, overwork, and exhaustion. And what's going to happen is, we all know this, the disease is going to go away. It's going to go back to business as normal. And the world's going to change, and there's going to be it's great time to make a lot of money, great time to be in business. But if you're burned out by the time COVID ends, if you've ever been burned out before, mental performance suffers at a significant, significant level. So we have told people during COVID, you want to double down on your primary flow activity, your active recovery protocol, and what I said earlier, that positive psychology is there's three great ways to sort of manage anxiety in any day, right? A daily gratitude practice, a daily mindfulness practice, or regular exercise, 20, 40 minutes a day. Usually in normal situations, what we tell people is pick one a day, right? Gratitude practice takes 5 minutes, 10 minutes or 11 minutes of focused respiration meditation, or 20 minutes of exercise, exercising until it's quiet upstairs, which is how you get the kind of mental health benefits. During times of crisis, two of these things a day or three of these things a day, depending on how hot your system is running. So you want to do that on the front end. You want to get 7-8 hours of sleep a night. You want regular access to flow. You want an active recovery protocol in place. And if you're doing all four of those things, burnout is almost impossible. And then when it is time to get back to work, you will be really ready for it.
So with the exercise, and I think you referred to it in your book as well, you talk about light exercise. And if we're talking to the average person here, who mentally, we're in the business world, we're not professional athletes. Is it light exercise or is it hard exercise that they're trying?
Well, it depends if you're trying to train grit, that's harder exercise, right? If you're working on grit skills. But if you're for cognitive fitness, you can a 20, 25 minute walk. You literally, like, you're going to exercise until and lightly until it gets quiet upstairs. Two things are going to happen. It's going to get quiet upstairs. So the voice in your head is going to get quieter and your lungs are going to open up. You'll feel your lungs open up. What those both reflect is a release of nitric oxide. It's a gaseous signaling molecule. It's in every cell in the body, basically. And as you kind of get to what's known as exercise-induced transient hypofrontality, it means the prefrontal cortex deactivates, the part of your brain that's worrying and thinking all the time. It shuts down, starts to shut down. It depends on your fitness level. If you're not fit at all, you can usually get there with 20, 25 minutes of walking, right? Slight uphill, slight uphill usually is more than enough. You know, depends on your fitness level. For me, you know, I have to ski really hard for about 90 minutes to get there. That's what it takes. But, you know, I run around with professional athletes when I'm not, you know, doing this.
Breaking bones.
Out of my freaking mind. No, we're done breaking bones. There's no more of that. I put down childish things. At least, you know, okay, that's not true. My shoulder's separated right now, but whatever.
Stephen, it's been great. I know the questions are rolling over. I'm respecting everybody's time. I promised that we'd end at noon here. Steve, could you maybe leave us? You got a sense of the audience. You got a bunch of questions. If there are the three things that you could leave us with at the end of today's session that we should think about, even slightly start to move us towards doing this, because, you know, I read your book. I read through the activities at the end. We're all capable of doing this, but most of us will start and we're going to fall off the wagon within a month or two. It's funny how, and it's not like we need technology. This is just hard stuff to actually do. You've simplified it, but it is hard to actually get motivated to do this stuff.
It's funny. I think it's only hard to get motivated to do this stuff until you start seeing the results. And the results are so spectacular, right? It is amazing what happens, right? We're seeing, I'll give you an example. We at the Flow Research Collective, right? Our training, our course, fundamental training is zero to dangerous. We see on the back end of it, it's 8 weeks long. It's hard as hell. Don't kid yourself, right? But we see a 70 to 80% boost in flow on the back end. This stuff is amazingly easy to train because it's our biology and it's designed to work this way. Right. So you can get spectacular results. And as those results, right now, getting to that point, you're not wrong. And so normally, by the way, Leon, when people ask me, what are the three things I can do Monday morning? My answer is always the same. Fuck off. Like, that's a ridiculous question. Like, I don't, whatever it is that you do for a living, can you tell me how to be great at it? What are the three things that allow me to be great at your job? Right? That's a silly question. It's a silly question anywhere. That said, I'm still going to help you out a little bit.
It's not to do. I'm thinking about behaviors.
So what we have found is this. If you're really interested in moving the needle, one of the greatest places to start is with sort of three simple activities. I'm not going to go into too much detail on how to do them because it's in the art of impossible and we're running out of time. But first, double down on your primary flow activity. We talked about this a lot today. It's really counterintuitive, but the results are really significant. So start there. The second thing is flow follows focus. Flow has triggers. What all the triggers do is they drive attention to the present moment. So the easiest place to start is with focus itself. What the research shows is if you want to maximize flow, try to start your day with a period of uninterrupted concentration devoted to your hardest task. Now, start your work day. If you are a extreme lark like me, you get up really early. That means you do it at 4 o'clock in the morning because that's when your circadian rhythms say you're most awake. If you're a normal person and you're like most awake at 9 a.m., that's when you do it. And if you're a night owl like my wife, you want to start at like 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening. You just want to match your circadian rhythm with a period for uninterrupted concentration. Prior to getting into that period, practice distraction management ahead of time. Don't try to resist temptation in the moment. What are you kidding? We're human beings. We don't resist temptation. We give in to temptation. That's what it means to be human, as far as I can tell. So phones get shut off. Email gets shut off. Facebook, Twitter, instant messages, all those alerts you've got. Turn them all off ahead of time so you're not even tempted. And what the research shows is what you want to aim for. Now, start with whatever you want to start with, right? If you've got 20 minutes today, that's what you start with. If you've got 25 tomorrow, that's what you start with. But what you want to aim for over time is a 90-minute block of uninterrupted concentration, because that's how long the brain is designed to naturally focus. We have 90-minute REM cycles, right? We all know this. We go into REM sleep, we dream for 90 minutes, and then we come out. Same thing. We have waking cycles, and they're 90 to 120 minutes long. So put this in context and give it familiar. Montessori education, Waldorf education, Montessori especially, when they went looking for the highest flow activities on earth, Montessori education is always very near the top. It's one of the reasons Montessori kids outperform, and Waldorf kids outperform other kids on pretty much every test you can give them. It's the amount of flow. Flow amplifies learning massively. Montessori works really well that way. Why does Montessori produce so much flow? One of the reasons is it's built around 1920 minute uninterrupted periods of concentration. They train the kids from 4 years of age to focus for that long. And the kids learn it really easily because your brain is actually, you know how freaking ADD kids seem to you, but once you start training it, human brain is built to focus for 90 minutes at a time. So it becomes remarkably easy over time. So distraction management on the front end, 90 minutes of uninterrupted concentration, double down on your primary flow activity, active recovery protocol, 7-8 hours of sleep a night. Now you're cooking with fire.
Not such a silly question. I love it.
Well, the reason it's silly is because it's three things to do Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, repeat, right? Peak performance works like compound interest. That's right.
I love it. Stephen, I want to thank you. Listen, all of you that joined us today, obviously, there's something that piqued your curiosity to come and join and to listen to Stephen. So you've taken actually one of the first steps. The second step I'd say is pick up his book, because, I mean, Stephen touched on a few things, but we didn't get to talk about learning, reading, how important it is. We didn't talk about creativity, you know, moving from a one winner idea to multiple and creating sustainable creativity. Just some great advice in there, Stephen, and you've done incredible research on it. I'd urge you all really to pick up that book. Again, thank you for all joining us. Thank you, Stephen. If you're interested in our other Way Forward live webcast, please visit us at po-leadership.com. You'll find a number of recorded past webcasts and podcasts that have included Professor Rosabeth Cantor, Professor Michael Beer, both from Harvard, Joe Jackman, Harry Kramer, Dr. Greg Wells, Dr. Jason Salk, Mitchell Goldhart. The list goes on. In the months ahead, we have some incredible thought leaders joining us, including Morgan Housel, Kim Scott, Janice Stein, Erica Dawan, and naming a few. It's an incredibly exciting lineup. Be sure to join us. And please spread the word. And if you're interested, happy to introduce you to what an advisory board could look like. Send me an email. Until we meet again, I'd like to wish you all a fantastic day and a wonderful month of March. Don't underestimate your potential and think big. Thanks very much.
Aird & Burliss is a prominent Canadian law firm with a well-established local, national and international practice. We provide strategic advice in all principal areas of business law. Regardless of size or sector, our professionals are dedicated to providing exceptional client service. Let us focus on your legal issues, so you can focus on your business. Contact Tony Gioia or Bill Chalmers to discuss ways we can work together.